Yeah, an essay by the Zen Master Dogen, where he talks about Zen practice, and near the end of that essay, he has a he writes, "Don't practice the Buddha Dharma. Don't practice Buddhist practice for your own sake. Don't practice it for other people's sake. You should practice the Buddha Dharma." For the sake of the Dharma, is the quote. And so the question is, what is the Dharma? You don't do it for yourself, you don't do it for others, but you do it for the sake of the Dharma. Maybe 10 days ago or so, there was this fantastic photograph in the local papers of the photograph from the Hubble spacecraft. And apparently there was this cloud tower was 300 trillion miles long, is that right? Light years long? I mean, it's kind of long. It's, you know, massive, massive cloud. And then it was somehow or other the cosmic winds had blown away the clouds around the center of where those clouds had been, I guess, and in there was a star being born. And so they said it was like seeing conception. Because it's very rare to kind of see a star being, and they've never seen it, I guess, a star being born. And for me, that was one of the most, qualifies probably as the most religious photograph from the cover of the Chronicle this year. And for me, kind of astronomy or those kind of photographs have a very religious or spiritual quality to them. And that when I was small, when I was a child, I used to spend a lot of time kind of gazing at the stars and thinking about the stars, and I'd read a little bit about astronomy, and I was kind of in awe at what I saw. And one of the reasons that I was in awe was that I felt I was a continuation of that cosmic process that you could see in the stars, that I was no different from that. To separate myself from all that, from nature and from the cosmic phenomena, was a kind of a delusion. And I felt very much at home in the world. I felt at home in this sky and this astronomy, this galaxy at least, because I felt like I was actually just part of it. That the universe comes together and created certain organic matter and then created life and created human beings was all part of the same unfolding of a process that was the same process that creates stars and creates 300 million light years long towers of clouds. I noticed as I was growing up that the way I felt wasn't always in harmony with the way I felt, the way I saw or understood my relationship with the world, with the cosmos. That I felt myself to be inseparable from it and part of it intimately, and that should make me feel, I reasoned that should make me feel at ease and at home with whatever happens to myself personally, especially dying. Being born and dying, just one piece of this you know, endless cosmic process. But I could see, I could feel how I was not in harmony with that view that I had. There were times in which I was afraid of many things. I was afraid of sometimes my reputation. I was afraid of what people would think of me. I was concerned about being someone, a certain kind of person in the eyes of my friends. And I'd be worried if I couldn't project myself in the right way, or if I felt like I'd failed in projecting myself in the way that I wanted to. I was afraid of dying. And I felt that was kind of unfortunate to be afraid of dying, since I'm sure I was going to die at some point or other. And so I felt this disjunction between this idea I had of being completely at home in the universe and at the same time feeling somehow being separate, independent from it, and therefore very vulnerable from the universe. And it was my contact with Buddhism, I felt, that began to allow me to heal that separation. I felt very at home in Buddhism when I first encountered it. Because at least intellectually, it seemed to be a tradition that confirmed for me the intimate interrelationship I felt I had with myself and the universe at large. Buddhism, the way Buddhism describes the unfolding of life is that life is a continuous and interactive process with the whole world. And that it's a kind of arrogance to take human beings and separate them from nature. That we are completely intermeshed, interdependent, co-arising with the wider cosmos, with nature. Where there's definitely a continuity. Even though this piece, this corner of the universe has consciousness. Buddhism is not a materialistic religion. It's just all just atoms kind of bouncing around and coming together in certain ways. But there's this wonderful thing called consciousness, which is somewhat of a mystery. But somehow consciousness is also an intimate part of this whole cosmic process. It's not doesn't make us separate from it either. And one of the things that Buddhism teaches is that that to be alive is to be in relationship. That we don't exist except in relationship. We don't have an existence separate from the relationships that help create who we are. And so that's kind of a doctrinal point of view. The interesting thing from Buddhist practice point of view is, given that, can we then find our level of trust or at homeness in this universe that we find ourselves in? And the universe we find ourselves in, the word that the Buddha used was loka, the world. In the early Buddhist discourses, he described two worlds that we live in. One is the world of empirical experience, of the world that we can see, that world of our experience that arises and passes, the world of our direct experience. That's one world. And the other world that we live in is the world of projection, where we project what he called permanence onto the world. That things really exist or things really don't exist. And this is considered to be a heresy in Buddhism, if there is such a thing in Buddhism. That things have some absolute existence or have some absolute non-existence. And so in the early Buddhist discourses, the Buddha said, there are two extremes that people tend to fall into. One is the extreme of thinking things exist, and the other extreme is to think that things don't exist. And rather, what I teach, the Buddha continued, is by understanding the arising and passing of phenomena, the arising and passing of life, I teach that things are codependently arisen, that things arise together in a codependent, co-originating process. There's a wonderful word that Thich Nhat Hanh uses, the interbeing, that who we are is interbeing. We're not human beings, we're interbeings. And I know in myself that when I feel at odds with the world or out of sorts with the world, that for me at least, I can recognize that I have fallen into one of these extremes of permanence or existence or non-existence. And it's usually for me into the world of existence. Or sometimes it's non-existence, but it takes a form like I am someone in a certain kind of way. Or I have a certain position, that position is absolute. And there's no sense of relativity involved or of interdependence or interrelationship going on. And it was very dramatic at this meeting. I was at a board meeting for the San Francisco Zen Center this last weekend. And it was fairly intense because we were talking about ethics and we were talking about voting, deciding who was going to be the next president of the Zen Center. So it was kind of heated. And we went around and you could see how there's a group process that happens. A group process has to do with the interrelationship of what people are saying with each other that's going on there. And sometimes you could see how the conversation flowed quite smoothly. And it seemed like one person would say something, another person would build on that, another person would respond directly to that, and they would build and build and build. And sometimes you would feel that someone would speak out, and it cut the group process. It just suddenly stopped dead. because they talked about something completely different. Or more often, what I saw in us, I was part of that, was people would often start off with long preambles about nothing at all except to tell everyone that that they were a considerate and kind person. So we were deciding on the next president, and there were two candidates. And so we went around the room to everybody was supposed to talk about who they kind of wanted to be president and why. And before anybody was willing to kind of venture forth and kind of give their opinion about who should be the president, they spent a long time talking about everybody's a really good candidate, and I think really well about this person, and really good about this person. And it was all very sweet. But, you know, when 15 people are doing this, it gets redundant after a while. And you could feel that project themselves in such a way that they were seen in a certain way, I felt. Which is a creation of an existing thing. To live in the world of interrelationship is not to create yourself in a situation, but to help create the situation. And it's a big difference between creating yourself in a situation and helping to create the situation. So a lot of what Buddhist practice has meant to me over the years is aligning myself or allowing myself to feel at home with this sense of my intimate interrelationship with the universe, which I often feel separated from. And I can feel it physically. I can feel physically when I feel connected and open, and when I feel separated and closed. And one of the things that separates me the most from others and from the world is fear. And when I feel fearful or apprehension, I feel that my center of attention or my center of energy or something moves from my stomach and it moves up my chest into my neck and up to my head. And I start living up here rather than relaxed and grounded down below. When I feel that, I feel myself that I exist in this way you're not supposed to exist in Buddhism. And it's painful. It causes difficulty. So a big part of, I feel, Buddhist practice and Buddhism is trust. It is learning to trust. And learning to trust just being part of this wider situation. And trust for me is the word trust is my preferred translation of the Pali word sadda or shraddha, which is usually translated into English as faith. Because in English, I think the word faith is a little bit ambiguous what it means. And for many of us, the definition of faith kind of slides in the direction of belief. You have to believe, you have faith in something means you believe in a certain thing. Whereas trust maybe slides more in the direction of confidence. You just simply trust being alive. You don't trust in something. You just kind of open-ended trust and open-heartedness and a willingness to be receptive. And I'm very fond that Indologists, people who study ancient Sanskrit texts, have pointed out that the original meaning for the word sadda or shraddha, that we translate as faith, the original ancient Indian meaning was hospitality. So to have faith or to have trust is to be hospitable to what? To our experience. To be willing to receive what's happening in some kind of hospitable way. And part of the trick, I think, of mindfulness practice, or the art of mindfulness, is discovering how it's possible to be hospitable to even when someone's yelling at you. Or even when things are really difficult, is it possible to stay receptive and be willing to be present? One possible definition of the self in Buddhist language, and this is possible in Buddhism because Buddhism doesn't believe in a self. There's many definitions of a self. But from a Buddhist point of view, what the self is resistance. Is when we set up a resistance to conditions as they are, to the world as they are, to the process of what's happening. So you can see it in the group meeting, in the board meeting. When people had to assert their self, there was resistance there to the group process. The group process that came to a stop, it was inhibited. When I feel like I have to defend myself or protect myself from someone, you know, yelling curses at me, or someone, you know, or what, defend myself against some imagination of what people are going to think of me, that kind of coming together, a constellation of fear around my chest and my neck and my head, that constellation is kind of resistance to a free, open reception of the unfolding of things as they are. So the self is a is resistance. And what's possible to find in practice with enough trust is a way of being that offers no resistance to what's going on. And it doesn't mean we're kind of pushover by any means. It means that you're able to make clear, responsible decisions. But it means that as things come to you and as things arise within us, there's no hooks for us to grab a hold on it. And because there's no hooks, there's no resistance in a sense, and things just can unfold in the way they're supposed to unfold. So we don't practice Buddhism for our own sake. We don't practice it for the sake of others. But we practice it for the sake of the Dharma. And Dharma has many meanings. And one of the meanings of Dharma is simply things as they are. But things as they are in Buddhism is not static. It's a process. And it's a process in which we're connected to, that we interrelate with. So to take to take refuge in the Dharma, to practice for the sake of the Dharma, is to practice for the sake of the unfolding process of the situation we find ourselves in. In order to be present for that, in order to do that, you have to be present. In order to be present, I propose to you, you have to be in your body. That it's very difficult to trust without being in your body. That trust is an embodied event. It's something that happens in the body, with the body. You kind of, it's almost as if it's kind of like a surrender of the body. That if trust is just an intellectual exercise, it's not going to go very far. It's not going to be real. And to be connected to the situation of the present moment is to connect with it almost in a physical way, an embodied way. And what you can feel this really well sometimes when you meditate. If you get a sense of it in your meditation, then it's possible to take that and notice it outside the meditation. But you can notice sometimes in meditation how, as you get drift off into distracted thought, you lose an embodied connection, a sense of being connected in your body. And you can follow that next time. As you follow your kind of mind, kind of wander away, see where your center of gravity is, where your attention is. And you might find that actually you're kind of having a disembodied kind of thought process. And then you can, if you can feel that, then you can come and bring back your attention into the body, to be in the body. And we say in Buddhism often that part of what concentration is a unification of the mind and the body. And that often seems a very abstract idea, but it means, in a sense, to allow the mind and the body, to allow the thought process, in a sense, the wandering mind, the attention itself, to reside in the body, to come together. It doesn't mean you have to stop thinking, but as you think, you can be in your body as you think. And cloud towers that are 300 million or light years or whatever tall are pretty amazing things. You know, I can notice that and kind of be amazed and kind of be inspired all day seeing that one photograph. But what I think happens to many of us, and certainly happens to me, is that we tend to dismiss our common experience. And that awakening or trust or interconnectedness involves being connected to the concrete experiences that are happening to us in our daily life all the time. It isn't necessarily, you know, these cosmic connections, as it's connections to our teacup when we drink our tea. It's our connection to the steering wheel of the car as we're driving. It's the connection to, you know, our clothes as we put them on. It's a connection to the chair that we get up from. Do we get up from a chair and just kind of let it be there? Or do we notice that chair exists in a whole situation, and that the placement of that chair has an appropriate place given the larger situation you find yourself in? That chair is also an interbeing event. And are we aware of the interbeing event of that chair, of the relationship that we have with the chair, the relationship we have with the whole situation, and the relationship the chair has with the whole situation? So, for example, if I get up from a table and push a chair back and have it 2 or 3 feet away from the table, and just get up and leave it there, I mean, that's, in some ways, that's fine. But it means that someone later is going to have to come, maybe, and want to rearrange and clean up after my mess. And that means someone's work. So if I take that larger situation into account, that chair is not only a relationship to myself, but it's a relationship to the others around me, maybe I would pay enough attention then to place the chair back at the table. So part of what I'm trying to say here is that I think many of us, and I include myself, tend to dismiss so easily our common experience. Maybe because it's too mundane or too boring or not interesting, it's not, you know, it's not spiritual enough or exciting enough or interesting enough. And so we don't pay attention to our teacup or to our steering wheel as we drive our car, or we don't pay attention to all these little details. But it's in those details, the mundane things, that we find our connectedness. And if we're going to find a level of trust in life that's not abstract but real, it's a kind of, can you find, what does trust mean as you meet your teacup, as you lift it up, as you put it down? What is our interconnectedness with our fork when we eat? What is trust? What is the Dharma for you? I was very impressed once. I did a 7-day Zen retreat, and there was a Japanese monk who was visiting. And at the beginning of the 7 days, they give you a teacup that becomes your teacup for 7 days. And every day in the middle of the afternoon, they come and serve you tea in a teacup. And you drink the tea, you know, you're sitting in meditation all afternoon, they ring a bell, you turn around, and you sit in meditation with a teacup in front of you. And you're sitting in meditation, and at some point they come and serve you tea, and the tea bowl, the teacup's then in front of you with the tea in it. And then at some point they ring a bell, and you can bow to the teacup and lift it up and drink it. And it's very kind of meditative, because you've hardly left your meditative state in this whole thing. So it's a very kind of wonderful way of being with a teacup. And then at the end of those 7 days, they come with a tray, and after the last tea period, they come and take the cup away. So there was this Japanese monk who was visiting, and he was sitting opposite me, so I could kind of see what he was doing. And what amazed me was that when it came to be his turn to return the teacup, most people, when they return the teacup, simply just kind of picked it up and put it on the tray, and that was it. When it was his turn to return the teacup, he bowed to the teacup, a deep bow to the teacup. And I thought that was really caught my attention. Why would anybody bow to a teacup? And I think that he was maybe, I don't know why, for him. Maybe, you know, he was confused. But what it was for me was a kind of an awakening to the possibility of really being intimate to something as mundane as a teacup, to really appreciate it and to be grateful for it, to have a connection with it. Something which, until then, I just kind of dismissed, you know. It was kind of very nice to have tea that way. But teacup, just a teacup, you know. Hopefully someone would wash it for me after I returned it. And to notice this care that he took. And I would propose that when he bowed to that teacup, he wasn't practicing the Dharma for his own sake. He wasn't practicing the Dharma for anybody else's sake. But he was practicing the Dharma for the sake of the Dharma. That it was just the event that was happening there. He was part of that event. And from the interrelationship he felt with that event, he was moved to do the appropriate thing, which was to bow. So those of you who are going to participate in December with bringing food to our homeless guests. You might make it an exercise to pay it to notice your motivation and notice whether you're doing this for your own sake or you're doing it for the sake of them or others or whether you're doing it for the sake of the Dharma, whatever the Dharma might mean for you. Good. Brigitte's not here. Oh, you're here. Oh, Brigitte told me to talk without notes. So I did. Yeah, I ran out of things to say. Well, I could keep talking, but I thought actually this is a good to now for having discussion, questions, which is good to have. Pesha.
Other inanimate objects, before and after they sit, things like that?
They do, but when I was first doing Zen practice, I was told that when you bow to the cushion, but I was told you're not bowing to your cushion. You're bowing to all the people who are sitting next to you. Even if they're not there yet, you're kind of bowing to your neighbors on that row that you're sitting with. And when you bow away from the seat, you're bowing to all the other people in the meditation hall. So you're bowing to the. So you're feeling. You're kind of. It's a wonderful practice because you're feeling this connectedness to others. You're not just. You're acknowledging that you're not meditating just alone, but you're meditating together with a group. But they say, you know, you bow to your cushion, but. Well, that's the form. But I'm sure some people bow to their cushion. I'm sure some people are very grateful for that cushion. And sometimes the opposite. Yes?
Could that man have been bowing to thank the person, the server who was taking the cup?
He could have, but I don't think so because that's part of the form, actually. The person who comes to pick up the cup stands in front of you and you bow together and then you pick up the cup and give it. So before even that person was even close, he was clearly bowing to the cup. There's a saying in Zen that when in doubt, bow. For the sake of. That's a good question. For the sake of. What does this for the sake of mean? I think one of the definitions is for the benefit of. I think. But what else?
Well, how does the Dharma for the, mean benefiting? I don't get it.
For the sake of. For the. Well, this is, you know, an English translation of some Japanese word. But that doesn't help much. What does someone else think?
Well, it's an intrinsic value.
Sorry?
You're not doing it for something else, you're doing it for itself.
For itself.
It's an intrinsic value rather than something that's done for the sake of something else.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
I thought the way you were describing the Dharma tonight was being in the present moment. Like, you're honoring whatever's going on at that moment.
I think the Dharma is more... Well, I could say that, but the Dharma is more than just the present moment. The Dharma includes our relationship to what's going on in the present moment, the interaction, the interrelationship.
Mm-hmm. More than that, it's the relationship of everything to everything else.
Yes, it is.
Takes light through us, so also by honoring that, the Dharma kind of like we become a vehicle for it.
In a sense, I don't know if we can become a vehicle for the Dharma. It's just the Dharma separate from us.
It is separate?
I don't think it can be a vehicle in the sense that to be a vehicle is almost to make it two different things. And we don't want to create that kind of distinction. It's more intimate than that. It is it.
I was thinking of it in terms of selflessness.
Yeah.
You know, giving up yourself.
Things as they are. But even being attached to the self is the Dharma. I think that's what you do it for its own sake. To do it for the sake of the Dharma is to do it for its own sake. But then the great question is, what does that mean? What is the sake? What is the situation that's unfolding in front of us that we should be participating in? And in order to know that, you have to be mindful. But I think more than just mindful, I think you need to feel intimate with the situation.
Well, that really raises a question in my mind. I have felt a lot of interbeingness with inanimate things. There's a lot of anthropomorphism going on. And in Western culture, that's really pretty much frowned upon. I'm not so sure it's so bad. But certainly, bowing to the cup has a quality of anthropomorphism to it, except so what? when you start getting real close to feeling real close with everything happening, it's important that the cup is there. And it becomes important to you, and you respond to it as if. Would you help me out?
I don't know. Maybe I'm too Western, but I feel that I think it's useful. It can be very, sometimes very useful for all kinds of for intuitive processes to work and to make intuitive connections and metaphoric connections. I think metaphor. I mean, much of human communication happens in metaphor. So. So to anthropomorphize, you know, just to kind of have another metaphor for what's happening. But what we're trying very hard to do in mindfulness practice is to try to lessen the degree of projection that we have on the world. And so in that sense, I mean, I think anthropomorphism is going in the wrong direction from the practice, perhaps, at times. Yes?
I think that the teacup might also mean gratitude.
Yeah.
I mean, its existence. I mean, probably the monk felt very connected in that moment, and he was mindful, and even the teacup played its role to his happiness in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a sense of gratitude, I think, is often a natural expression of being connected with the Dharma. It seems like it's almost the Dharma itself is grateful to itself. So last the comment or question.
Well, I think it's more in line with what you were saying, but the tea isn't any good without a cup. And it's the emptiness or things as they are isn't any good without a form, isn't any good without manifestation. Mm-hmm. And so it's not so much that I'm manifesting or it is manifesting, but there is form, there is something manifesting, and that is the sacred conception of the universe. Like there's this mist, but there is a something happening there. And we don't know what it is in terms of concepts, but it's related to everything.
So you can feel the relationship. And then one of the points that I think is so important for us to try to remember is that even the most mundane, simple things are sacred from a Buddhist point of view. And to be interested in the spiritual side of mindfulness practice, to be interested in the world of awakening, but then to dismiss your dinner dishes, or dismiss these kind of all these little mundane details of our life, is actually to miss a great opportunity, because it's not going to be found anywhere else. It's nice to have these photographs to be inspired up sometimes, but can you be just as inspired by what? By little everyday kind of occurrences that are happening all the time. Anyway, so this was my experiment in talking without notes. Thank you.